Thank you. And a very special thank you to Tim and Sharon, two people I deeply appreciate, and I hope you do too. And I count it a privilege to be here today. Marriage. In a moment I'm going to tell you who I'm talking to, but there was a young bride who rang up her mother shortly after she was married. She was just totally distressed, in tears, emotionally overcome. And her mother said on the phone, "What's the matter, dear?" She said, "Oh, it's terrible, Mother. It's terrible." "Well, what's terrible?" "This marriage thing, it's terrible." "Why?" "Because he's changed. He's using four-letter words." "Well, calm down, dear. What sort of four-letter words?" "They're terrible words, Mother. Four-letter words. I can't handle all these four-letter words." "Like what, dear?" "Like cook, wash, wipe." Well, I thought that was funny when I heard it, but anyway, four-letter words. Of course, there was these three guys in Queensland recently at a conference, and they got talking, and it turns out that there was a guy from Queensland, a guy from New South Wales, and a guy from Tasmania, and they're talking about marriage, and it turns out they all had the same problem, you know, their wives. And the guy from Queensland said, "Look, you know, I came home and there was nothing in the pantry. So I said to my wife, 'Not good enough. If I don't see food in that pantry within 3 days, look out.' First day went by, second day went by, and on the third day, there was food in that pantry." The guy from New South Wales says, "That's incredible. I've got the same problem, except there wasn't food in the pantry and the washing wasn't done. So I said to my wife, I said, 'Wife, if I don't see food in that pantry and this washing done in 3 days, look out.' First day went by, no food in the pantry, washing wasn't done. Second day, no food in the pantry. Third day, pantry full, washing all done." "Yeah, that's how you be a husband." The guy from Tasmania says, "Well, that's nothing. I had the same problem. There was no food in the pantry, washing wasn't done, and tea wasn't being cooked. So I said to my wife, I said, 'Lovey, wife, if I don't see food in that pantry, if I don't see the washing done, if I don't see dinner on that table within 3 days, look out. If I don't see it.' First day, could see nothing. Second day, see nothing. Third day, I could see a little bit out the left eye." You don't mess with a Tasmanian woman. Yeah, you see, in some parts of Tasmania, that's not funny. Now, in a few weeks' time, it will be Kim, who's with me today, it will be our 24th wedding anniversary. Thank you. 26 or so years ago, I was convinced I was going to be a bachelor. And I was positive that that was my life. Until I came into a season, I'd never experienced anything like it. I just had this incredible sense of almost darkness. And being a Christian and understanding the spiritual realm, I fasted. I thought this was a demonic thing, and I fasted for 3 days. In fact, I went on what's called an absolute fast. I don't advise anybody to do that, which is where you don't eat or drink for 3 days, trying to break this darkness from off my life. At the end of the 3 days, nothing much had changed. I hadn't had any great blinding revelation from God, and my life was still pretty much the same, except for the fact that within about a week, I had the weirdest dream I've ever had in my life. And I'm not someone who has lots of dreams and visions and things like that, but on this particular night, I had what became a series of dreams over a few nights. And I dreamt of a girl who had bleached blonde hair, who had four earrings in each ear, and I saw details of her life, and I'm hearing conversations happening in the dream, and it was so vivid. It was one of those dreams that I woke up in the morning and I remembered the dream, and it's just highly unusual. And there was one little problem with the dream. I thought I even heard her name in the dream, and I was fairly sure, and you'll understand why for me this is a problem, because, well, I thought I heard her name was Ken. Now, in some parts of New South Wales, that's not a problem, but for me, theologically, I couldn't sort of frame that. So I was at Deakin University, an overseas Christian fellowship meeting, and most of my friends were 5'4", jet black hair Malaysians. And on this particular meeting, there was another Australian there. And the leader of the group came up to me just as I was packing my guitar up and said, I don't know if you noticed, there was another Aussie here tonight. You might want to just say hello. So between me and the door was this girl. And as I went to the door, I thought, well, I'll do the polite thing. I'll just say goodbye. So I went up to the girl to say goodbye, as the leader said, be polite to do that. And as soon as I looked at her, and guys, listen to me. Do not say the first thing that comes into your head when you see a girl. Because the first thing that came into my head when I saw this girl was, oh, you're the girl of my dreams. I didn't say that. Yeah, I got something right. That was the thing I got right. And I looked at her and I realized that this is the girl. This is the girl. I just had the drip, blonde hair, four earrings. Hello, what's your name? Kim. Oh, thank God. I was so relieved to hear that my dream hearing was off. And I said to her, look, and I'm not given to boldness, and I just had a rush of boldness, and I said to her, look, I don't know if this means anything to you, but are you by any chance going through, and I began to say some of the things I'd seen in the dream. Next thing, she just flops to the floor and is bawling. Oh, I don't even know how to talk to girls, let alone talk to bawling, crying girls. I had no idea. So I thought, well, here goes. So I just got down on the floor and just kept talking. Just kept saying things I'd seen in the dream and just said, look, I think God's got a call on you. She was not a Christian. Her side of the story is that she'd reached bottom in her life and she'd cried out to God, please speak to me. She was at the hitching stands at Deakin University, and the first car that pulled up, she had said, God, I know I need you in my life, and probably what I'm about to do, hitchhiking and all this, is probably not good, but if the first car stops, I'll get in it. If it doesn't stop, I'll never get in another car in my life. And the first car stopped, and it was a little Asian girl. Kim got in the car, and on the dash in a big sticker was, Jesus loves you. And the girl said to Kim, I never pick up hitchhikers. I don't know what I'm doing. And Kim just said, tell me about this. And she said, well, we've got a meeting tonight. Do you want to come? And I've told you what happened, basically. So that's how I met Kim. And we were married some 18 months after that. And marriage is the closest thing you'll experience to heaven on earth. And I'm living that. And this is not something that I treat lightly. When I hear people talk about marriage in a flippant way, when I hear people talk about, you know, I've been married 20 years, you only get 15 for life, you know, I don't find that funny. I really don't. I don't trivialise marriage. I think it's very sacred, and I hope to show you why. So there's really three people I'm going to talk to, and I don't know who you are, but there are three people here today that I'm going to talk to. One is, you're here and and you've not been married, you're not married, but you will be, I want to say some things to you that could literally change your future. The second person I'm talking to is you're married, and your marriage is not what it should be. I'm talking to you today. And to a lesser extent, and in this order, I'm talking to someone else today, and you're the person who's been married, and it didn't go well. I want to say some things to you as well. So come with me on this journey as we look at marriage as God intended. So this is marriage as God intended. If you've got your Bibles, if you have, that's okay. That'd be wonderful. If you haven't, no problem. But we are going to anchor this in Genesis chapter 2. We are largely going to ground what I'm going to say in six verses of Scripture. And we're going to start in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18. So, you see it on the screen there, it says this. Genesis 2, 18. Then the Lord God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make a helper fit for him." Genesis 2:18. Let's skip a few verses. Let's go down to verse 21. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man. There's a couple of interesting things here, and I haven't got time to bring it out, but there is a picture here of Christ birthing the church out of his death and resurrection. Just by the way, there's also another picture happening here, and that is that for a man to be attractive as a prospective husband, there has to be a certain ease about him. Women don't find incredibly intense guys all that attractive. God had to put Adam to sleep. He was in a position of rest. Just by the way, so there's two pictures happening here. And while he slept, he took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. Verse 22. And the rib that God took, that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Verse 23. Then the man said, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man." And verse 24. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. There's a whole lot of truth and concepts in here, which I hope we can now begin to unpack. So the first thing I want you to see is that when God brought Adam and Eve together, he didn't bring Eve to Adam and say, "This is now your friend, this is now your helper, this is now your servant." He brought Eve to Adam and married them. He married them. God was the celebrant. God was the witness. God was the father of the bride. God was the orchestrator. In other words, I want you to see from the very beginning of time, marriage is God's design. There's some really silly things that are said about marriage. One of them is that it's just a social contract that's developed over thousands of years, and man has kind of invented it. Really, it's for the benefit of the man so that he can control a woman. Well, let me tell you, that if we had time, we would really hit that hard, because marriage is good for women. Because what are the alternatives? The alternatives are that a woman is not married and she's used and abused. Marriage dignifies a woman. So marriage is God's design. So notice this, God took Adam, and then he took something out of Adam. It's called a rib. Whatever it was, but whatever it was, he took something out of Adam and he invested whatever he took out into the woman. So Adam is less than what he was, and what he is less is embodied in the woman. When they come together, The word is wedding. We think of it as a ceremony, but it is actually something that happens when two people are wed together, male and female. The thing that is lacking in Eve, she hasn't got all of what Adam was. Adam now hasn't got all that he was. But when they come together, they become whole and complete. That's why it says in Genesis 2, they shall become one. And the Hebrew word is echad, which means not one, but one, like that. One. Interestingly, Deuteronomy 6 says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is echad, one." And I'm going to come to this in a moment. So human beings were created for marriage. Created for marriage. Marriage wasn't an afterthought. It wasn't like God created Adam and Eve and said, "Well, if you're going to do that, I had no idea. Well, you guys better get married." It wasn't like that. Marriage was from the beginning. Now, I want you to notice back in verse 18, God said this, "It's not good for man to be alone. It's not good that a man should be alone." Marriage solves a whole bunch of problems. It's not good for man to be alone. You know, we are created in a certain way. That means we are not created to be in isolation. It's not good for man to be alone. What happens when you put a man in solitary confinement? Psychologists tell us he'll go crazy. It's not good for a man to be alone. It's a part of God's design that people be connected. And marriage is the ultimate connection. It's not good for man to be alone. God created Adam to reproduce. This is the sexual nature of all of us. In fact, God has created us sexual. You're created sexual. I think, just by the way, one of the problems we've got in the church is that we don't talk about sex enough. And we kind of treat it as, well, we're not going to talk about that because it's like just such a thing. No, it's not. It's in Genesis 2. It's in Genesis 1, if you know where to look for it, it's there. In other words, it's in the very beginning of the Bible. So this is really important. I know that some people say, well, I love my wife, I love my husband, it's not about the sex. Well, that just tells me that either you're kidding or you're lying, especially if you're a bloke. Because we need to have a grander vision of God's plan for marriage. And it involves sexual intimacy. We're created sexual. Now, sin, of course, has distorted sex. And that's why Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 7 that it is good for a man to marry, so that distortion of his sexuality is curbed within marriage. That's just by the way. So you're created sexual. You're also created, not good for man to be alone, we're created to be sociable. We are created with a capacity to get along with others. And now, I tell you, something that every church that's going to grow needs to learn, and something that every person who wants to grow as a person's got to learn, is how to be sociable. Do you realise that there are some people today, because we live in such a digital age, you know, it used to be in the old days when you wanted the volume turned up in your TV, we had a dial. Looking at me like, what are you talking about? Well, trust me, there were things called dials on TVs and it had volume written on it. You had to dial it up. Now, people turn up the volume. Well, we had that intermediate step between dials and remotes. They were called kids. And but back in the day, that called an analog dial. And it used to be that relationships kind of worked that way. You got to know someone a little bit, got to know them a little bit more, got to know them a bit more. Eventually, you got right over here to trust them. It seems like that's gone out the window now, where we've got off, on, the 0-1, off, 1, on, digital. I meet you, I'm in bed with you tonight, I won't see you tomorrow. What the heck is that? But that's how the world's doing relationships now, that's digital relationships. And that's not being very sociable. We're actually created to be sociable. You know, that kind of lifestyle, strangely, ironically, leads people to be more lonely than ever before. It's not God's design for how we are to connect socially, were actually designed. So that means this, that Adam was going to, notice how many wives God gave Adam? One. Now, this is the closest relationship you will ever experience in your life. One person. And if we had the time, I'd do this. I'd put you in a concentric circle. I'd put another circle around you and go right around and go, okay, you're right in the middle. Who's in the next one? Well, it should be your spouse. In most marriages, it isn't. In most marriages, it's you, take a circle, maybe take another circle, go another circle, and your spouse is probably there. And your goal over your marriage is to kind of get you both into the same center. But if you think you're there now, you're kidding yourself. But I want you to notice this. If we kept going out here to these circles, you would have out here a whole bunch of people where most of the people you relate to should be. They're called acquaintances. I know Facebook calls them friends. Oh. Look, all seven of my Facebook friends are close to me. I feel their pain. By the way, if you haven't got many Facebook friends, friend me, I'll friend anyone. Just, when you're desperate for Facebook numbers, call me. Really, we need to get this right, that in the very middle there'll be one person with who we are totally transparent. That was God's design. You're created to be sociable to limits and extents. Please understand this. So this one person who's right in that middle circle, is that this is the one you're created to be intimate with. You're not created to be intimate with a whole bunch of people. Now, thank you, Rod. You've got this. I just want to... We can edit that out later. I want to show you this in a minute, how this illustrates. In fact, let's show you. You're created to be intimate. Let's say this is the wife. No, it's blank, isn't it? This is the husband. You know, sometimes wives ask their husbands that horrible question, "What are you thinking?" And the guy says, "Nothing." And the wife goes, "Oh, no, really." It's possible. So let's take intimacy. You may have seen this, but let's take sexual intimacy. Here's the sticky tape. And sex is meant to be the glue that binds two people together in the most loving way physically. And let's put this tape on here. So we're sticking this on here, and there it is. They are now bound, and that's supposed to stay there for the rest of your life. That's how it's supposed to be. That's intimate. Look at that, one. Thank you for getting clear tape. That is awesome, because that really illustrates it well. Clear tape, there it is. Imagine if that was not the husband and the wife. Imagine if that was just a one-night stand. No problem. Just find someone else. Someone else who's blank. And let's just take this and let's just bind this one here. No problem. And see you later in the morning. Now that's gone. Well, that's no problem. We'll just bind you to someone else. No problem. It's just intimacy. This is how intimacy in the 21st century works. Whoops, that's not so sticky anymore. But no problem, we'll just bind you to someone else. And that's not sticking so good now. Because that's not how intimacy is supposed to work. It's not supposed to have you looking like that. I've got some good news for you, if that's how you feel. Jesus Christ loves you, and he can redeem you. He can give you hope. Gee, this is a messy church. Look at this. Adam and Eve. Notice the first thing Adam said of Eve. You, as someone said, when Adam saw Eve, he goes, "Whoa, man. Woman. You shall be the mother of all living." Now, they're right there from the beginning. Marriage is about parenting. You're created to be a parent. It's interesting how this comes out, especially in little girls. In fact, I asked Ruby, I said, Ruby, who's out in the kids' church now, I said, Ruby, do you have a baby? She goes, yeah. I said, well, what's your baby's name? It's okay to have this conversation with a five-year-old. It's when it's a 15-year-old that you want to be a little bit more careful with how you go about this conversation. She said, Binti. I said, is Binti your baby? Yeah. I said, could you bring your baby to church this morning? I said, yeah. Here's Binti. Binti's got a bottle. Drink it. Come on. This is Binti, and if you're wondering, Binti is apparently a girl's name. And Ruby's had this ever since she was born. So Binti is just a little bit older than Ruby, if you can sort of do the maths. And for Ruby, this is her baby. And Binti goes, well, Binti would go everywhere with her if we let her. Ruby actually has a whole bunch of illnesses and so on. And when someone gave her this teddy, we discovered that the softness of Binti actually soothed Ruby's condition. And so she loves Binti. But this is my little girl. She's playing mummies. All little girls do that. Sorry, Binti. And so you're designed to be a parent. It's a part of your design. Even if you're not a parent, you're still mother. Even if you're not a dad, you're still in some way. You can't help it. You'll see a kid about to cross the road when there's a truck coming. Hey, son, where'd that come from? Because there's something in us called to be a parent. We're created in God's image, and this is probably the most profound thing, that in Genesis 1, which gives the overview, and Genesis 2 then comes into a different perspective. It tells the same story. If you've ever seen the movie Vantage Point, it tells the same story. Vantage Point tells the same story seven different ways, and you get a different picture each time, but it's the same story. Genesis 2 tells the same story as Genesis 1, but the focus isn't from out in space looking at Earth being formed. The focus is now this patch of dirt that's nothing, and everything's been done, and now God plants a garden in this nothing. This is Eden, and then he didn't create Adam in Eden. He brought Adam to Eden, so it's a different perspective. And then the animals that were already created, he brings them, and not good enough. But this man, Adam, it says, was created in the image of God. Created to represent God. All creation is supposed to be able to look at mankind, Adam, and go, ah, that's what God's like. That's how it's supposed to work. And so marriage between Adam and Eve, man and woman, because something was taken out of Adam, put into Eve, and something is not in Eve that is in Adam. When you come together, the two people, marriage, best represents the picture of God. So marriage is about God's image. And again, we could really unpack this. But I want you to see that because God created Adam and Eve, and the first thing he did, the first type of relationship he had for them was marriage. You've got to understand the heart of God in this. His heart is for your good. In fact, it's beyond good. God's heart for you is your best. God will never do anything to you or for you that is not for your best. Romans 8:28. We need to get this. Now, here's where I'm going to talk to my third audience. Because there are some people that are going, marriage, I've tried that. That was nothing but abuse and neglect and betrayal. Just preach away, buddy. Just preach it away. You don't know what you're talking. You haven't been in the marriage. Okay, I'm talking to you now. Because I hope that you can look at your situation and go, I could have done a couple of things different. Because I have talked with hundreds, maybe thousands of people, and this is their story. I could have done a few things different. Oh, what could you have done different? Well, here's where I'm now talking to my first audience, and I want you to listen to the people in the third category. So if you haven't been married yet, you will be. Here's what you need to know about God's design for marriage, because it's for your best. And the first thing you need to know is prevention is better than cure. It's easier to prevent a marriage problem than to cure one. How do you prevent marriage problems? You build trust over time. If you met someone last week and you're already engaged to them, you need to speak to Pastor Tim or Pastor Sharon yesterday. I mean, this is serious stuff. This is not the way to lay a good foundation for your marriage. Secondly, so you need to build trust over time. Secondly, you need good coaching advice. Now, today I happened to bring a tennis racket. And I happened to bring a tennis ball and a tennis racket. Before I was a Christian, or around about the time I became a Christian, I was embarked on a professional tennis career pathway. And that was going to be my life. I was going to be a professional tennis player. Except I had one little problem. While I could serve really well, who would like me to serve this ball to them? Where's Marty? Where are you, Marty? Marty, all right, you can catch. I played Marty the other night. Right, ready? Catch. This is the orange ball, so I figured Marty knows what that means. But if it hits someone, it won't knock him out for an hour. it'll be, hey, I saw Roger Federer knock a cup. Why don't you get a cup? No. Okay, ready? So watch this. So here's the serve. Hey, you said you're going to catch it. Now, anyway, we didn't hurt anybody. Marty, can I have the ball, please? All right, thank you. Thank you. All right, now, that's the serve. So there's the serve. Now, watch my feet, my left foot forward. Da-da. Well, I had a problem when I was a 15-year-old elite junior, and that was my coach said, well, basically, to smash a ball at the net is right foot forward and just do exactly the same as the serve. And I'm doing that, and balls are getting sprayed everywhere. It was terrible, and I felt terrible. I was losing matches because I couldn't smash a ball at the net. Don't you use that next time we play. Now, there was this old coach who came down from Queensland, and he stood on the sideline, this old guy, 70 years of age. He stood there, and he goes, He said, you know what you're doing wrong? I said, I've got no idea what I'm doing wrong. He said, you're putting your wrong foot forward. I said, no, I'm not. I'm doing exactly, this is how you do a serve. You do the serve like this, and you ka-chung, but the right foot, left foot, sorry. The other right foot, the left foot. And he said, no, that's not a smash. The smash is actually your other foot forward. Now, at the moment I do this, and he said, bring the racket down and touch the bottom of your shoe on your right foot. And I did that, first go. You ready, Marty? Like Beaker. First time I did that, I smashed the ball. I couldn't believe it. This guy took 15 seconds to explain to me how to improve what I was doing. In 15 seconds, he totally transformed my game. That's what good advice can do for your marriage before you get married. Good advice can save you years of heartache. The third thing you need to do, and it's part of God's design, is to figure out how you're going to resolve conflict and how you're going to communicate with each other. And here's one factor that keeps coming up in all of the statistics. If you live together before you get married, you are twice as likely to divorce. Twice as likely to divorce. So, people who say you should try before you buy are setting themselves up for failure. The marriage is the highest commitment, and sexual intimacy is the highest expression of physical love. It demands the highest commitment. God's design is for people to be married, and it involves that commitment so that there can be sexual union. When God brought Adam to Eve, he said, one flesh, one. And there's a word for that, and it's the word covenant. You see, a contract would be one person going, we'll see how this goes. That's a contract. But marriage is not a contract. God's design for marriage is covenant. And a covenant is where you give yourself utterly, mutually give yourself. There's a whole bunch of things that go in with a covenant, the exchange of rings, the exchange of names, a pledge to give everything you have. When I got married, Kim said, you realise everything you have is now mine? I said, oh, Okay. And everything I have is still mine? Obviously, there's a whole bunch of guys here who didn't find that funny at all. So marriage is a picture. Let's bring this to a close. Marriage is a picture. What's it a picture of? It's a picture of God. You see, you've got God, Adam, and Eve. In Proverbs chapter 2, it says, the wife who strays from a marriage forgets the covenant she made with her husband and God. You see, when you marry, you're standing before a representative of God, a minister, who leads you through a covenant you make with God and with your spouse. There's a triangulated agreement that you're making here. And marriage, husband, wife, God, three different entities. It's the difference that complements. And that's why it's a picture of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Marriage is a picture of the Trinity. Marriage is also a picture of Christ and his church. It says that in Ephesians chapter 5. Notice, if we just look at some of the things that you make when you vow, when you do your wedding vow. I don't ask a couple, do you take this man to be your lawfully wedded husband? I don't ask that because do you is what you're going to do right now. That's not what marriage is about. I sometimes have couples come to me wanting me to marry them and they're more interested in the wedding. The wedding for me is 5 to 10% of what we're about here now. Your marriage is what's really important. That's why I don't ask, do you? I ask, will you? Because will you is ongoing and it's an act of your will. Notice these words in the wedding vows. Where else do you hear these words? Love, cherish, honour, keep. Boy, if we had time, we'd unpack those. One of the first things I do with a couple that are in trouble is that I'll say to them, okay, you made a vow to each other. Did you happen to vow to each other on your wedding day to honour each other? Yeah, I think so, yeah. So how seriously did you take these vows? Oh, yeah, pretty seriously. Okay, tell me what honour means. I got no idea. In fact, 100% of the hundreds of couples that I've counselled for marriage crisis, 100% of them, when I ask this question, not one of them has been able to tell me what it means to honour. Not one. And I'm thinking, you made a vow to do that and you don't even know what it is? And so we just unpack this and this is how we pull marriages back together. But this is God's design. Ephesians 3, 18 and 19 sort of talks about this. Wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. This is the essence of what it means to love, cherish, honour and keep. To keep just doesn't mean to have in possession. It means to guard. Jude says, may the Lord bless and keep you. Keep you. And that's what marriage is supposed to be. And so as we think about this, Eve, she's the wife. What's the responsibilities of a wife in marriage? What did God intend for a wife? Well, firstly, I'd be asking every wife who's asking these questions, what's my role? What's my responsibility? I'd come back to the wedding vows and go, okay, what did you vow? Because there's going to be a big clue right there. And part of it is to love, cherish, honour and keep. You've got to do that. So what's the main role and responsibility of a wife in God's design for marriage? It's to help her husband to be the best he can be, to be the best man he can be. You see, a wife brings to a man that which is missing from him. And it makes him the person that God had originally created him to be. That's why a man needs a woman, because it's complementing him. The same goes for a man. What does a wife do? She brings out the best in her husband. That's the main role and responsibility. What about a husband? What does he do? Well, I like these three P's. A husband is called by God to protect, to pastor, and to provide. The three roles might be defined as this: protector, priest, and provider. And this is God's design for a man to do this for his wife under ordinary circumstances. I want to close with just a thought out of chapter 4, verse 1, where it says this. And it's a strange verse, but I want to unpack it and then bring this to a close. Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived. How many times have I heard of a couple where after 30, 40 years of marriage, in fact, I had a couple that had been married 45 years, the wife came to me one day and said, "I don't know my husband." You've been married 45 years and you don't know your husband's what I'm thinking. I don't know him. I can't talk with him. I don't understand him. 45 years. The sad thing is that 2 days later, the husband came up to me and he said, "I don't know my wife." I'm thinking, you two guys should talk. I should introduce you. I couldn't tell them that each of them had come independently to me. Man, that's sad. Adam knew Eve. This is one of the intentions of marriage, because I said to you before, if we were to do the concentric circles, where's your spouse? Is she, if you think she's right in the middle, if she, you're kidding. Part of the goal of marriage is to get as close as you can. Adam knew Eve. What does it mean to know? To listen. To understand. To feel. To be intimate with. How do we know that? Because look at what the verse says. He knew Eve, and what happened? She conceived. That's intimacy. It's intimacy right there. And if we had the time, we'd look at the role of sexual intimacy within marriage and how vitally important it is. In fact, I'm not advocating this, but I heard of one pastor who was having all kinds of marriage problems in his church, and he went to prayer and he said, "God, I don't know what to do. So many couples are in strife." And God spoke one word to him: "Have a sexathon." And going, "Devil, I bind you. What is it?" God said, "Call the couples of your church to commit to each other sexually anew." What? So he took a risk. He announced that coming up, I think it was October, which they called Sextober or something. And I've never done it. Don't ever tell. If you get back, don't tell anyone at Ghana I even mention this, because this is not appropriate for any pulpit that I know of to talk like this. And he said to his church, "Through the month of October, we are going to have couples in this church commit to being intimate with each other every day of this month." What a call. But you know, the strange thing, is at the end of that month, the problems that people were having kind of vanished. People were laughing and smiling. People were happy. People were resolving issues. And we so don't understand the role spiritually of sexual intimacy. Adam knew Eve and she conceived. Powerful, powerful verse. Ladies and gentlemen, this is marriage as God intended. Thank you.
Wow, did you enjoy that? It was fantastic, wasn't it? Andrew, funny you should say that last thing. My birthday happens to be in October. Let's not go there, okay? Yeah, no, we so much appreciate you coming and just blessing us as you have, and it's just a... Guys, it's just fantastic having Andrew in close proximity to us, and he just continues to bless us when he comes and speaks here, and he speaks at most of the Ignite intensities that we put on these days. And yeah, can we just give him one more round of applause and really show how much we appreciate it? Well, I'll pass over to Julianne and the team now, and you can bless us with some more worship.
So if I get you all to stand, we're going to finish the service with a